yesterday morning in the first part was, of course, some background to the text itself. And then we looked at the first paragraph, which is concerned with the essence of ethics, if you remember. In some ways, this is one of the most important contributions of a Sangha to the whole Buddhist tradition about ethics. So I'm going to go a little bit further into that and then proceed with another very important contribution of a Sangha's. So if you remember, he says the essence of ethics is to correctly receive it from someone else, which means to take on the ethics, the precepts, in a context of communication, where you are in relation to a teacher, Kalyana Mitra, someone with greater experience than you, which everybody here has done to some degree. Even if the first time you go to the centre, you recite the refuges and precepts, you're doing it in that context. You're receiving it in the context of the Sangha. Then, of course, when you become a Mitra, you, in a sense, receive the refuges and precepts from the order members present, and especially from the person conducting the ceremony. When you are ordained, you receive the precepts from your preceptor, so that your ethics is conducted within the context of a relationship. Not just one relationship, but of relationship. Then there's the quite purified intention, which implies, first of all, that you've got a genuine, awakened ethical sensitivity, ethical sensibility, you could say, and that you want to develop ethics, you want to practice the precepts so that that sensibility is awakened more and more and your behaviour becomes more and more ethical. Then thirdly, there's making correction after failure, which we will do. We will fail, for sure. If you take on a set of precepts, if you take on an ethical standard, you do it because you know you're not at that level. So inevitably, you're going to fall down. You're going to break the precepts to some degree, to some extent. And especially the more refined and subtle the precepts become, the more likely you are to break them. It's relatively easy to avoid, I was going to say to telling lies, but actually it's not so easy, is it? But once you take on, for instance, the mind precepts, which you do at ordination, it's very much more difficult to refrain from covetousness or to refrain from hatred, and believe me, even more difficult to refrain from wrong views. If you think you are doing that, then that's a wrong view. So the more punctilious and subtle you are in your practice of ethics, the more likely you are to fail. But, I won't say that's okay, but if you make correction after failure, if you put it right, then you are practicing ethics. Ethics consists of, you could say, aspiring, failing, making good, and then trying to set things up so you don't do it again. The fourth aspect of the essence of ethics is this maintaining mindfulness of the other, of the one from whom you've received the ethics, or the context within which you've received the ethics, and keeping your sensibility alive through that awareness. If you have a teacher, if you have Kalyana Mitras, if you have a preceptor, even if you can relate to Bhante or to the Buddha, you keep yourself aware of them so that that maintains your own sensitivity, your own sensibility, so that you're much more easily able to realise that you're doing wrong. So these are Asanga's four aspects of the essence of ethics. But actually, I think if we really understand these and identify them in our own experience and practice, there's almost nothing else to be said. But This is a large work, so I've got to keep going. I've got a frog in my throat. Sangha proceeds in the text to then dot all the T's and cross all the I's. No? Cross all the T's and dot all the I's in the classic way of Abhidhamma. Sometimes when you're reading Abhidhamma text, you, after a little bit, you say, yeah, I've got that. I could work that out for myself. But it does it all in absolute detail. But actually, it's quite interesting what is done. Before I just briefly take you through what Asanga says about the relationship of these four and how they work to preserve ethics, I want to go a little bit further back into the nature of ethics, into what, in a sense, Asanga is basing himself on, if you like, the essence of the essence of ethics. I alluded to it yesterday, the fact that an ethical sensibility is an aspect of a developing consciousness. It's natural to us. The easiest equivalence is with aesthetics. You know that aesthetics is not a question of knowing that something is beautiful or something is harmonious or whatever. It's a question of directly experiencing it as such. When you hear that piece of music, it thrills you, or it resonates within you. When you see that beautiful piece of countryside, you don't have to be told this is beautiful. You immediately feel it. In other words, consciousness has implicit in it a sense of value. Huh? This is really important. Value isn't something added to consciousness. It's something drawn out of consciousness. Is one of the most important things that we can get hold of. The aesthetic sense can be educated. In other words, you can become more aesthetically sensitive, but it can't be put onto you, if you see what I mean. You know the way when you're with a friend who has a very fine sensibility, and they discuss some work, maybe a film or a piece of music or a painting or whatever, and they express what it is about that really touches them. And in the course of doing that, your own sensibility is enlarged or made more subtle. It's not that you apply a sort of conceptual formula to it, and therefore, because it's like that, therefore it's beautiful. It just teaches you where to look or where to listen, where to place your ear. I remember this especially learning to listen to Indian music, which in many ways is so different from Western music. For instance, it's non-teleological. It doesn't have a sort of sense of going somewhere. It doesn't have a narrative structure. Of course, it's not absolutely true that it doesn't. This is what the minimalists were inspired by. But, first of all, you need to know that, so you relax that that sort of aspect of the aesthetic sensibility, the musical aesthetic sensibility, which is looking for a development or an unfoldment. Then the thing that I found most helpful was to focus on the tambura, the instrument that's just providing a ground in a Western musical sense, and the tabla. You listen to that. The other instrument, whether it's a solo instrument or other instruments playing together, sort of come into proportion and you can hear them. Now, somebody told me that next time I listen to Indian music, I put my ear there and suddenly it comes to life. It comes to reveal itself. So an aesthetic educator isn't giving you information that merely sort of tells you that something is beautiful or delightful or whatever. They are helping you to listen or look more subtly. And in a way, it's the same with ethics. We've all got an innate ethical responsiveness. That is a responsiveness to life, you could say. We've got that because we are alive. So there's a response from the life in us to the life in other things. To begin with, you don't necessarily have a very highly developed sense of the life in other things. And you can harm other living creatures without really feeling you're doing anything. Children do this, don't they? I remember myself. It's horrible, but I remember that I lived in Africa at the time, and I remember I had an air rifle, and I used to shoot lizards, just for the marksmanship of it. And one day, I saw a lizard fall off the wall, and I can see it to this day, lie there quivering because I'd broken its back, and it suddenly hit me. I've destroyed a living being. I've caused it intense pain. But before that, it just wasn't in my mind. Never sort of looked at the world in that sort of way. So the ethical sensibility is there, but unless it's drawn out, and it depends quite a bit on circumstances and situations, it can easily be dampened and closed off. And as I put it yesterday, a sort of carapace of insensitivity covers it up. It's sort of there in a way, because life calls to life. And so the resonance is there, but you've hidden that resonance from yourself. So an ethical education is the same as an aesthetic education. It's putting yourself in contact with people with a greater ethical sensibility than you, and through your contact with them, allowing that ethical sensibility to emerge more and more fully, more and more subtly. That's essentially what Asanga is talking about. It's talking about this natural capacity that life has to resonate with life. And when that life is conscious of itself, when it's self-conscious, that resonance becomes both more powerful, and there's a greater capacity to dampen it, if you see what I mean. Because the self-awareness then breeds a conflict between self and world around. So an ethical training is a training in a natural capacity that you already have, a natural ethical responsiveness, capacity for ethical responsiveness. I doubt if anybody is completely without it, even in the worst of evil. I suspect there's always some capacity for that responsiveness. I thought that film Downfall about the last days of Hitler with Bruno Ganz, brilliant performance, which itself was an ethical masterpiece. His ability to even identify with such an evil man is the only way to put it. But what he managed to do was show that Hitler did have some sensitivity. He loved his dog. He liked his secretary and so forth. So I suspect that everybody has that capacity, albeit dampened in various ways by life experience, by ideology, by theories of various kinds. But everybody has that capacity. And when you undertake an ethical training, you're recognising that you've got that it needs opening up. I don't know whether you experience this on retreat. I've often noticed this. When you come off a retreat, you're much, much more sensitive in every way. Much more sensitive to ugliness and to beauty. Much more sensitive to skillfulness and unskillfulness. And much more sensitive to your own actions. But you notice that gradually that dies away. Well, I notice that gradually dies away, and you sort of revert to the pre-existing a sort of level of ethical awareness. So what we're trying to do is to educate our ethical mindfulness, ethical awareness. Awareness is not just about the collection of facts, the collection of data. Awareness is value, awareness of value in the world around us. So this is what Sangha is pointing to. In Buddhist psychology, and I can recommend you to look this up in Mind in Harmony, or any other book if you want, there are three main terms that refer to this sort of ethical sensibility. The first I mentioned, well, all three of them I mentioned yesterday, but I want to clarify them a bit further. First of all is kalkrutya, which you remember I referred to as paired with audatya or audacha kukutya, which always sounds like as a Brazilian dance. Kalkrutya, krutya means doing, done, as in karma, kr. It's an important root in Sanskrit. Kal means bad, wrong. It's the opposite of su, as in subhuti. Sometimes I'm kubhuti, but that's another question. kalkrutya means something done wrong. And it's the most immediate ethical responsiveness. It's that feeling, ow, whoops, ouch, wish I hadn't done that. It can be, as I said yesterday, merely functional. Did I lock my door? Did I turn the candles off in the shrine room? That sort of, it's not exactly ethical, but that sort of functional sensibility. But most importantly, it's a sense that you've done wrong. And actually in the hindrances, kalkrutya primarily means your sense of guilt. I mean in the positive sense of guilt, not the neurotic sense of fear that you will be punished by big figures in your life, and especially the big one up in the sky, if you see what I mean. That's not kalkrutya, that's fear, which is another matter altogether. Kalkrutya here is your natural sense that you've transgressed life in some way, whether your own or others. And you carry with you a sense of that transgression, and which then prevents you from meditating. So kalkrutya, more than anything in the context of the hindrances, means clarifying what that kalkrutya is, seeing what it's about. I personally think it's a very important part of ethical training to notice that kalkrutya, that sense of remorse. Some of us have to do some work to disentangle it from fear of big figures in our lives, or fear of rejection by the group. That's different. That's not kalkrutya proper. That's neurotic or unhealthy, unwholesome guilt. But once we've sort of distinguished that, you can begin to almost cherish this sense of something wrong. I've tried to train myself in this, just to sort of notice, I don't feel good. What's that? I did this. I didn't do that. Sometimes quite small things. I said something to somebody and there was a little tinge of something in it, a little thorn in it, a little punch in it, which disguised underneath it all, or whatever. Or a deliberately not doing something when you know you should, and so on. So it's ethical training means becoming more aware of this. According to classical Buddhist tradition, kalkrutya is stimulated in two different ways. These are very important terms for what when we go through the next paragraph. Hri or hiri, which is usually translated as something like shame, and ottapa or apatrapya in Sanskrit, which is really difficult to translate. We don't really have an equivalent in Western ethical tradition. But it's often translated as fear of blame, but that gives completely the wrong sense of it. But it's the awakening of kokrutya, of remorse within you, because you're aware that somebody you respect would not have acted like that, or would have acted like that, if you see what I mean, whether it's omission or commission. So it's your ethical sensibility, your ethical awareness, stimulated by your reflection, your recollection of somebody who you respect, especially the person from whom you've received the precepts. You through your awareness of them, you think, I shouldn't have done that. So it doesn't matter in a way which it is that stimulates, whether it's the inner sense that I've not lived up to my own values, I've not lived up to my own standards, my own aspirations, and a sense of shame, and a positive sense of I wish I hadn't done that. Remorse is probably a better word, regret. It's the sense that I did do that, I really wish I hadn't. I regret that I've done it, and I take responsibility for having done it. So kokrutya is stimulated in this internal way by your own values, your own awareness that you want to live up to certain values, and your remorse, your regret that you've not done so, or by your awareness of somebody else who you admire, respect, and have genuine reasons for doing so, and that then reawakens your ethical sensibility. So these are the primary fundamental mental states that underlie everything Asanga is talking about. And they're really important for us to get hold of. As I say, all three of those are not nice to feel. You don't feel good about it. But nonetheless, they are kushala chaita dharmas. They're skillful mental states, which is a very important lesson. And I know myself, coming from the 60s and the whole sort of breaking free from guilt, breaking free from social convention and so forth, I really was very reluctant to think that there might be a sort of positive kind of guilt, if you see what I mean, because guilt for me was all Freudian, a repression of my natural instincts and so forth. It's not. Some parts of guilt are to do with your natural ethical sensibility, and that's either stimulated by your aspiration to live more ethically, or your awareness of others or someone in particular who holds those ethical values for you. And yes, an ethical training is primarily to do with cherishing these feelings. The odd thing is that if you really learn to love your kokrutya, if you really learn to sort of cherish your regret and face up to it, it's extraordinarily joyful. It's odd. But if you really sort of accept, I did do that, I really wish I hadn't, and then you do the things that are necessary to put it right, which is primarily confession, a full recognition of what you've done, and a bring it out in the context of an ethical community, and especially in relation to your ethical teachers, as it were, your preceptors. If you do that, confession can be remarkably joyful. But of course, confession isn't enough. You must, if possible, apologize to whoever it is you've harmed. It's not always possible. Sometimes apologizing is actually counterproductive. So you have to take advice on that. And as much as you can, making it good. And then trying to see what you have to do in order not to do it again. That means analysing how it came about, what the sort of processes were that led to it, and then trying to see how you can avoid doing that again. These are, to me, the crucial aspects of ethics. First of all, experiencing, accepting the remorse, accepting it fully, embracing it, then confessing it so that you bring it out into the light of day in the right context. And, you know, sometimes you have to be careful because it's maybe quite sensitive. Then, thirdly, doing what you can to resolve it with the person or people or situation which you have harmed. If possible, apologising, but again, it's not always the most sensible thing to do. It depends on the context. But at least doing what you can to put things straight. And then finally, seeing what happened, how it happened, what the mental processes were, what the external conditions were, and working out a strategy to avoid it in the future. Part of that strategy, if it's a particularly repetitive failing, may be to work it out with somebody else so they'll keep an eye on you. Yeah? There you are. Needn't go on. That's really what he's getting at. I've teased out more fully what he's getting at. If you engage in this process of really full and deep exploration of what happened, and starting with accepting kokrutya and then working it all out, you find yourself in a delightful, positive state, which I referred to yesterday but referred to wrongly. It's the state which in Sanskrit is avipratishara. In Pali it's avipatisara. Avi means not, and patisara is something like uneasy or even guilty, you could say. So the state of avipatisara is the state of innocence, the state of freedom from inner guilt, the state of knowing that you've not done anything wrong, or whatever you have done wrong, you've done something about. So it's a very important state of mind from a Buddhist point of view, to be in a condition of innocence. Innocence because you faced up to whatever you've done wrong. In some versions of the positive nidanas, avipatisara replaces pamoja. Yeah, you're all with me? You remember the positive nidanas which go, oh no, I shouldn't have started on this. Dukkha, Shraddha, Pamoja. Well, in some lists, instead of going from suffering to faith to joy, it goes suffering, faith, innocence. Innocence of mind. So it's that wonderful sense that there's nothing to reproach yourself for. That whatever you've done, you've made good. In Buddhism, this is considered to be almost a sine qua non for further development. Unless you have a fairly constant touching down on a sense of innocence, it's very difficult for you to go further. This is why ethics precedes meditation. Because if you've not got your ethics sorted out, when you meditate, if you're getting at all open, then kokrutya will arise, a sense of guilt will arise, and that will prevent you from usefully going further. You can go further into meditation, but it's by a sort of forcible squeezing of the mind into a more exalted state, which cannot be sustained. So one needs to do quite a bit of work on the inner dimension of ethics. But the inner dimension of ethics, of course, involves taking on an ethical standard in relation to others, clarifying your own motivation, seeing that sensibility and aspiring to work it out. It involves, thirdly, punctiliously putting things right when you've failed, which you will. And fourthly, maintaining that ethical relationship, the relationship with your teachers, relationship with the community, so that you're constantly reminded of your ethical aspiration. Particularly to begin with, it can be very easy to forget, especially if you're in an environment where those values are not shared. So these four help you to develop Hri and Apatrapya. They help you to be conscious of Kokrutya, and that helps you to develop Avipratishara, innocence of mind. Interestingly, in Buddhist tradition, Hri and Apatrapya, that is, inner-directed shame, as it were, inner-directed remorse, and outer-stimulated remorse, are known as the two lokapalas, guardians of the world, because they guard the world against unskillfulness. It's the natural ethical sensibility that prevents the world from collapsing into total selfishness and unskillfulness. So Asanga is showing us how to work this out. Then he works out a little bit of Abhidharma-like detail. These two phenomena, the correct reception and the purified intention, so having it properly received from someone else in a proper context, a context especially that may be ceremonial, because the ceremony gives the taking on an extra power, an extra potency. That's the point of ceremony, isn't it? That it embodies a context of values that support the action that you're taking. If you take the precepts on in front of the Buddha image after puja and so forth, it has a much greater significance, a much greater weight. More of the mind resonates with what you do. So correctly receiving it from others means correctly in terms of mental state, attitude, right people and so forth, but also the right context. That's why we have these ceremonies. Then purified intention, perhaps enough said about that. That's what induces the other two phenomena, correction after failure and respect that avoids failure. Yeah, because you've got those two in place, then you naturally put it right. Because your own ethical sensibility and your awareness of the other makes you put it right. Your having correctly received it keeps alive your respect that avoids failure in the future, yeah? These three phenomena, the correct reception from someone else, the quite purified intention, and respect to avoid failure, should be understood to effectively prevent the failure of Buddhist bodhisattva ethics. The correction of failure should be understood to constitute rectification and recovery from breakage. Well, of course, yes, quite. Thank you for spelling things out so exhaustively. So, these four work together. That's really important. And it's worth everybody reflecting on their own lives to see to what extent these four are actively represented. And in all their ramifications, as I've spelled it out, have you got a context where you've really received the precepts? Have you got an awareness of your own ethical sensibility? Are you aware of remorse? Do you value remorse? Have you a context within which you can confess? Have you people you can talk to who won't say, never mind, just have a drink, don't worry about it? And sometimes they may need to say at least the latter part of it, because you may be worrying about nothing, or maybe just expressing neurotic or unhealthy guilt. But are the people who will say to you, yes, that was wrong, But what are you going to do about it? You know, I can help you. So have you got that? An ethical community? Are you part of an ethical community? And do you have a sort of punctiliousness about putting right whatever you do wrong? And are you remaining conscious of the Sangha as a whole, and of your teachers in particular, in such a way that you are restrained from habitual and even sort of immediate acts of unskillfulness? That's what we all need to be looking at. Do we have a sufficiently strong ethical environment and that will help us to do what we need to do in order to grow our ethical sensibility? Okay, so then the Sangha tells us the benefit of all this. He says that this undertaking to proceed and train oneself in the essence of ethics endowed with these four qualities should be understood as wholesome. That is kushala, I presume. I haven't got the Sanskrit. But presumably it means kushala, skillful. Because it benefits you. It's skillful in the most immediate sense because it makes you happy. It makes you act more effectively in a way that prevents you from falling into trouble. It makes you live in a more smooth way, avoiding the greatest dangers and difficulties. Skillful action leads to a smoother path through life. Can't avoid all difficulties and dangers because life is difficulties and dangers. But you can, through skillful action, you can learn to find your way through in the way that's most beneficial, most positive for you. Benefit for others, a benefit for many people. So, yes, you benefit people immediately because you don't harm them. And because you also provide a sort of an ethical standard. You know, it's a wonderful thing to come in contact with somebody who lives ethically, more ethically than you, even for those who don't have much sense of ethics. So you're contributing to the world by acting ethically. First place, not by harming them, but then by, well, hopefully benefiting them. There's that wonderful incident when Milarepa's sister comes to visit him because she's had a hard time. And so she goes to visit Milarepa, climbing high into the mountains and spending some time with him. And she keeps every morning saying, okay, well, I've got to go back now. And Milarepa just stops her. He just prevents her from going. And eventually, after several days, she says, look, I really want to go, but you keep stopping me. Why are you stopping me? He said, well, every moment you're here, you're not doing evil down there. So, yes, you benefit many people when you act skillfully. And it's pleasure for divine and human beings. It's a very interesting aspect of Buddhist tradition that when you create merit, that is, when you act skillfully, it's said, and this is a rather literal way of putting it, there's sort of something for the gods to feed on. The gods like positive action because they themselves have been born into these more exalted mental states because of their own skillful action. And they can't perform any in these states. These states are, as it were, passive. So they sort of feed on the skillful states of others. And it's said that you can take this however you like. I'm not going to try to interpret it. One could do, but let's just take it at face value. It's said that the gods are sort of attracted. These subtle beings are attracted to skillful action, wherever it may be. And So he's referring to that here. As I say, you can probably make some sense of this, but I'm not going to delay on that at the moment. It's measureless because the Bodhisattva's training can't be encapsulated in just a few words. If you like, the Bodhisattva's training means that ethics has to be worked out afresh in every living situation. You cannot have an exhaustive principle that covers everything. Even you'll find in this text, it may be necessary at times for the Bodhisattva to take life, if that taking of life prevents further suffering. That's a hard one. There's a lot of debate about this in the Mahayana. Is it possible? Is it necessary? And so forth. But I'm offering it just as an illustration rather than as a principle. I think probably for most of us, don't go there. I hit him because it was best. They used to tell me at school, this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you. Whack, whack, whack. Yeah, like hell. But you get the point that the ethical principles can never be entirely exhaustive. That the Mahayana became increasingly aware of this because the monastic precepts, the Vinaya, forbade the monk or the nun from certain things, for instance, handling money, for a monk, touching a woman, for a nun, the same, the other way around. There are times when, if a woman has collapsed in the road and you need to get her out of the way of the traffic coming, you don't stand on your Vinaya. You need to just go and do it. And there may be other principles like that. So the Bodhisattva holds to a higher principle, which is the benefit of all living beings. And a lot of what we're going to be dealing with later is the sort of complex calculus that involves. How do you work it out? It's not as simple as the rules that govern the monastic life. So it's measureless, if you see what I mean. It's every situation requires a fresh ethical response. They're lived for the benefit and pleasure of all sentient beings. These ethical precepts are favourable to all sentient beings. Because they acquire and bestow the result of supreme right and full awakening, samyak sambodhi, they should be understood to be a great result and advantage. So the Bodhisattva's ethics ultimately confer Buddhahood. Buddhahood in the complete sense, that is, of taking rebirth in a situation where there is no Dharma. Going into that situation and starting it all up, all over again. That's the definition of a Buddha, isn't it? So the Bodhisattva's life is lived in order to awaken beings in a situation where there's no Dhamma. You're preparing yourself to be reborn as a Buddha, as the Mahayana says our Buddha did. Prepared himself over countless lifetimes so that he could be reborn in this time when all trace of the Dhamma had been lost. So your practice of ethics is part of your developing, equipping yourself to be a Buddha. Okay? That's what you're doing when you take on the Bodhisattva aspect of ethics. You're equipping yourself to be a Buddha. I'm going to have to go into this a little bit more, but I will wait till after the break. But I'll just introduce the next section of the text. We've done one page, which is pretty good for a day and a half. So we've done what is the essence of ethics. Now we move on to what is complete ethics, the second of his nine headings. And it's this that we'll concentrate on for the rest of the session of the retreat. We're not going to do everything under that heading, but we'll do some of the most important parts of it. So what is complete ethics? Well, he says the Bodhisattva ethics is comprised by the lay side and the monastic side. This is complete ethics. So remember the context. This is in 2nd century India, when Buddhism has been going, developed for, 700 years, and quite a complex Buddhist culture has developed, which is particularly focused on the monasteries, some of which were huge, 10, 15, 20,000 monks and smaller ones for nuns. The monasteries that survived in Tibet, Sera, Drepung and Gendan and so forth, were simply those Indian monasteries transported into Tibet. As one Tibetan expressed it to me, Tibetan Buddhism has kept Indian Buddhism in the deep freeze. It's taken into the mountains. More or less what you get is exactly Buddhism as it would have been in Pala Dynasty India in the 8th, 9th century. So by the time Asanga was writing this text, there's been huge monasteries, a very large number of monks and nuns all over India, and supported by a laity, who increasing the duty of laity was to just feed the monks and worship. Come to the monasteries, come to the stupas especially, and worship them. And, practice the precepts, live a good life. But in a way, often, not much more was required of them in the most extreme forms of this. Again, I'm giving you an interpretation which any reputable scholar will tear to pieces in 5 minutes. But it's probably a good enough, charcoal sketch of the situation. So this is quite strong division between the monks and nuns on the one hand and the lay people on the other. The monks and nuns would be following these complex codes of ethical conduct, which were partly ethical and partly customary. They describe the way of life. So that if you're part of this community, you do this, you don't do that, you wear your robe in this sort of way, and so on. There are a number of different Vinayas, different schools. We've got three that have come down to us, the Theravada, which is observed by the schools of the Theravada in Southeast Asia, the Mula Savastivada, which is observed by the Tibetans to this day, and the Dhammaguptaka, which I think that's right, which is observed by the Chinese and Japanese. So three different versions of the Vinaya. So the monks and nuns' lives were dominated by these rules, these codes of conduct. I'm not saying that they were formalistic, but they were quite strongly codified, and they implied a sort of purity of a practice on which the lay people depended, because the more pure the person you gave alms to, the greater the merit you got. And so you'd got already by this time the beginnings of what I call the merit economy, which is one where the monks, and to a lesser extent nowadays, because there are very few of them, nuns, at least in Southeast Asia, live a pure life, a nominally pure life, and the lay people give to them and get merit for a better rebirth. So already you'd got this sort of bifurcation of the Buddhist life, that there were the people who were nominally leading the real Buddhist life. Actually, they were mainly engaged in textual memorization and study and following of the Vinaya. There were meditators at this time. There's still quite strong meditation traditions within the monastic side. Then you've got lay people who kept the five precepts and looked after the lay people. And again, there are many exceptions to that. But lay people would have practiced meditation. Some would have practiced meditation. But as a broad brushstroke, you've got these two distinct ways of life which had a sort of symbiotic relationship with each other in terms of the merit economy. Now, forgive me, this is vastly oversimplified, but it gives you some idea of the background against which Asanga was speaking. So he's saying, but bodhisattvas, it's not about being a monk or a nun or a lay person. Being a bodhisattva is about saving sentient beings and trying to prepare yourself to become a Buddha. So he and the whole Mahayana before him, they were looking at what it is that unifies the whole Buddhist community. What it is that draws them together. And what they effectively were saying, the Mahayana was saying, was that what unites us is our aspiration to Buddhahood. And we can all do that, independent of what lifestyle we're leading. And independent of what lifestyle we're leading, we have a common set of ethical precepts, ethical principles. A Sangha is the first one to codify what those ethical precepts were. And all, as far as I know, there may have been others in other strands, but this is one of the most important, which has come to us in the precepts that Bhante took from Dada Rinpoche. So the complete ethics is saying ethics isn't just about this code of conduct or that code of conduct. It's about the fundamental aspiration to gain full and perfect Buddhahood. So we'll come back and we'll look a bit more closely at what that means in detail. And I'll need to look a little bit at the Bodhisattva ideal. And we'll return at 12.